Okay. Why do you sometimes say Brahman and sometimes say Ishwara? Brahman means just the Satchitatma, Satchitananda Atma, which is non-dual. So the infinite yourself, which is in truth, infinite, the self of Ishwara. When we bring in the Maya Upadhi, we say Ishwara. So say, it's really heuristic, it's kind of a teaching device in a way, because the teaching really is the Mahavakya, which means that you, O Jiva, the Jiva is Ishwara. And so the Jiva is limited, Ishwara is limitless. So on that level, that doesn't make any sense, that the limited Jiva is the limitless Ishwara. And so there has to be a point of identity. And that point of identity that has to be revealed is that the self, the Atma, the self of the Jiva, is the self, Brahman, of Ishwara. So Atma is Brahman. So on that level, there is the oneness, the identity. And so without making this distinction between the self and the upadhi for both the conditioning agent for both the jiva and for Ishwara, there is no identity. And so what is the identity has to do with this underlying factor of Atma being Brahman. But now say you just say Brahman, I can say all of this is only Brahman, because mitya has no self, no being apart from Brahman. Just like I can say, you know, the entire pot is only clay. Because clay is what is actually there. And in terms of this mitya creation, this whole Maya Upadhi, what is only there really, as anything that is satyam real, is Brahman. So I can say Brahman, and including in Brahman, I can include the whole universe. Because there is only Brahman here. But if I want to make the distinction and talk about this creation and this, Srishti Stiti Laya, the manifestation and the sustenance and coming back, this process, then I want to talk about this Maya Upadhi and its relationship to Brahman. And so then I bring in Ishwara, Brahman with Ishwara, or Brahman with Maya is Ishwara. If I'm just looking at Brahman as just Brahman, as the Satchitananda Swarupa, the very nature of Satchitananda, that is Brahman. If I'm just looking at that, then I'm not including the Maya Upadhi. Though I can include the Maya Upadhi, because the Maya Upadhi is mitya and it has no independent reality apart from Brahman. So teaching, but with teaching to show that you are Brahman, you have to recognize what about you is Brahman. Or you are infinite. You are Ishwara, I mean, to say you are Ishwara. What about you as Ishwara? Then we have to do the viveka by showing, differentiating myself from the panchakoshas, from the three shariras, using these teaching methodologies to differentiate myself from the upadis, from the body-mind-sense organs. And now that we've started, now we have to be able to differentiate Brahman from all of the Ishwara upadis, which we're now starting on to do. So that's what the difference is. The most important part is to be able to make this equation that the Atma is Brahman, you know, that the Jiva is Ishwara, because the self of the Jiva is the self of Ishwara. So that's why. Mumukshu versus Jnani, what's the difference? So this is in the light of gaining self-knowledge. So the Mumukshu is one who desires liberation. The Jnani, so now we mean the one who has Atma-Jnanam, who has self-knowledge. Okay, that self-knowledge, that one who has self-knowledge, the Mumukshu-twam has been fulfilled. Because actually, to be a little tiny bit more thorough, you start out as a seeker, being one who desires liberation, but you don't know really how how to get that liberation, or what the means for that is. And so as you get exposed to the teaching, you realize that the means for liberation is self-knowledge, because in fact the self, yourself, is already liberated. So the problem that is making you feel bound is self-ignorance. And so as you start to understand that, then the desire for liberation morphs into the desire for self-knowledge, because self-knowledge is liberation. The one who has self-knowledge is called a jnani. And so that jnani, the one who has atma-jnanam, the one, so we call the jnani, that one is liberated, means that one has self-knowledge, because liberation and self-knowledge are the same thing. They're the same thing because the self is already liberated, so it's just a matter of ignorance that's causing you to project all of these issues, all of these desires and everything. It's all because of self-ignorance. So that self-ignorance can only be eliminated by knowledge. You know, then once you get knowledge, then what do? There's nothing more to do at all, because you already are complete. Yeah. We have sadhanas like do shravana manana nididhyasana in order to help break this dehatma buddhi, this conviction that I am the body, mind, sense organs. As I said, but that's all part of gaining knowledge, really, gaining clarity. What do they mean with heavens? well, the concept of heaven is different, quite different in say India or in the Vedic tradition than it is, say, in Christianity, for instance. In Christianity, you have one birth, and then if you follow Dharma, then you will go to heaven. And in some Protestants, it's you will go to heaven anyway because Jesus died for your sins. So there's different theologies there. But it's one life, and then you either go to heaven and that's permanent, or you go to hell and that is permanent, or the purgatory. I think I mentioned that. Now, in the Vedic tradition, there is this bhuloka, this particular loka, where this world that where we are right now, it's called the bhuloka. It's the middle loka. It's in between seven worlds up and seven worlds down. And it's in this loka where you can actually attain liberation, and you also have free will, and so you accrue karma, punya and papa, in this loka. Whereas most of the other lokas going up are more like dream states. They're objective. They're not just your imagination, but they're where there's really no free will. There's just the experience of positive experiences. But at the Satya Loka, and I think maybe even some of the lower lokas, but the first ones are more just like dream state. In the highest loka, the Satya Loka, that is considered the heaven, you know, the highest one of the states, and they'll call that the equivalent. It's not really an equivalent, but anyway, it's similar to heaven in other traditions. But the difference is that in that loka, you would, for instance, you'd have a body that it's at the prime of life and it doesn't age. You would have food and water. You would never be wanting for these type of things. You'd never fall ill. So all of these kind of doshas, these defects or these things that cause pain are not there in that loka. And as you desire something, that desire is fulfilled. And so you don't have to worry about raga, dvesha, and all of these kind of things. It's irrelevant because as you desire it, you get it. And there's no death experience. So that's considered a heavenly world, what people that are within samsara might want. You know, let me live forever and get everything that I want and be happy. And the thing is, what's really different is that even though that highest loka, the Satya Loka, it will last until the end of the kalpa when there's a total dissolution. So you will be in that loka for that long because of the tremendous amount of punya you've accrued to be able to to have that type of a long-term reward. But when the dissolution of the creation takes place, which is it does cyclically, at that time your punya is over. And so then again you'll be reborn as a jiva. And then again, whatever the karmas are, you know, you'll take a body and be here in this bhuloka to accrue more punya and papa. So the thing is, and it's the same with the hell world, there's levels of hell, each one's getting worse and worse. You get to the bottom ones, the various, but it's time bound because it is a result of your papa. And that the papa karma itself is something that's accrued from a time bound actions. And so they will only give the limited result, limited result. Limited pola, right? Because the action was limited. And so in the West, we don't have that idea. Everything is, you go to hell, you're in hell, that's it, forever. Eternal hell, eternal heaven. But in the East, it isn't like that. Those lokas, some very positive lokas and negative lokas, are just places where for a period of time you are in that situation as a result of your karmas. Does that make sense? That's what it is. How would you explain to a group of students hearing the term karma for the first time? How would you explain karma to trauma survivors and to victims of war and genocide and massive disasters? In Vedanta, do we have the ability to chase the next life, to choose the next life we were born into? Well, if I was explaining it like at school to a group of students, and like if I'm teaching a class where I teach a class called Eastern Theories of Self-Mind and Nature, and I kind of talk about the whole Vedic culture, and then and that Vedic culture and the tribal cultures also of India, and how what was the basic culture, the Vedic culture itself, are certain concepts and understandings that are there in all of the different darshanas, like whether it be Buddhism or what we call Bauda or the Sankhya Yoga or the Advaita Vedanta or any of these different darshanas. They all come out of that Vedic culture, and so they have a lot of common understandings, like for instance reincarnation, karma, these lokas, the cyclical nature of the creation, that there is such a thing as a guru, meditation, you know, punya and papa. All of these things are there. The darshan itself, the philosophical part, might define all of these things and give the logic for these things a little differently, but those ideas are all there. They're all shared. Karma is one of those. And karma is a word that has made its way around the world. And so how I start to explain it is, I would say, well, just, you know, how you will often say, well, that's my karma. You know, people say that. What do you mean? What do you mean when you say that that's my karma? Well, usually we mean that this, what's happening to me right now, is the result of previous actions. And so when we use karma, that's normally what we mean. It's my karma. You know, you get what you deserve, as Swamiji says. Or you might say something like, wow, that's such good karma. You know, what do you mean when you say that? It means that this is a really positive result of past actions. That's what when you say that, that's most likely what it means. And then I talk about what the word karma actually means, and it comes from the root kra, and it means an action, you know. And karma actually has a lot of different meanings, but when you're using the word, this is usually what you mean. And then if they ask more, if they want to know more, then I explain that in terms of your actions as a jiva, you know, that there are what we call drishta karmas and adrishta karmas. I use those terms. And I said drishta karmas that have to do, you're talking about the, really with karma, you're talking about the karma pala, the result of the action. And if you say the seen drishta karmas, those are like drishta palas, they're the seen results of your action. So if I do an action in the world, you know, like say I'm thirsty, I want a drink of water, I walk across the room and I get a drink of water. You know, that's an action and the result I get right here and now. The adrishta pala would be something like, I'm just making this up, it would be if I needed a drink of water and I walked to get a drink of water, but it turns out there's only enough water left, you know, in the water jug for like a half a glass of water, and that there's some elders there or some young children and they need that water. And so I give them that water because they need it more than I do. That's a punya karma. That would be punya because I'm giving. You know, I'm sacrificing, I'm giving something also. So that would be a punya karma. And that would have meritorious results in my next life. You know, in terms of the unseen, adrishtapala would be punya. The drishtapala would be that these elders and children got water and I didn't. That would be, you see what I mean? So I talk about that, and I talk about punya and papa, these two things. I talk about the sanchitta karma, where the karma, karmas that have not yet been exhausted, karma polas that have not yet fructified go into what we call sanchitta. They're waiting for an opportunity to fructify. The prarabdha karma is the karma that is here right now. You know, and then that gives us our life. And then the agami karmas, so the karmas that that you accrue while you're here. So we all have all of these different understandings of karma that kind of paint the whole picture. And that's what I talk about if somebody asks, especially in that class where it's relevant to the class. You know, depends on how much the person wants to know. Can go on and on and on. I just asked you what karma is. I just want to do, you know, a few words, that's all. And how would you explain karma to trauma survivors, to victims of war and genocide and massive disasters? You know, that gets into an arena where we cannot legitimately talk about another person's karma. Like, oh, you know, you really were in a bad situation and you must have really bad karma. You really can't say that. You have no idea what is going on there in that collective karma or individual karma. You don't know if there's abuse of free will, or you have no idea and what that person is there. Why that person is there and that to experience that particular karma. It's fine to say, well, you know, that was my misfortune, it must be my bad, you know, my negative karma. Maybe I did something in my last life to deserve this. And then you have to say, and you don't really know. Because karma itself, the possibilities and the cause and effect threads are next to infinite that has gone into what has caused you to take a particular birth. For instance, what I was saying to the other day about the little ones, our little babies here, and the, you know, the my nieces and nephews and your nieces and nephews, such beautiful little children. Why are they, you know, born now into this really chaotic time, and they're going to have to face so much because, you know, it's already the, it's almost, you know, we're almost like a fifth of the way through the century. And some of these devastation is going to start really showing up around 2040, 2050, and then by the end of the century. It's just crazy. If the projections, if they say, why are these beautiful children that have dharmic parents wonderfully, really good parents, and they're so beautiful, and the parents are also dharmic. They're not a dharmis. They wouldn't be attracted to a dharmic family, you know. And then you just see how sweet and beautiful they are. And then you say, well, it must be really your bad karma to be born at this time. Now, sometimes I'll say that about myself being born at this time. Well, you know, I mean, it's our karma that we're all experiencing the chaos and the climate change and the crazy politics and so many horrific things actually are being experienced at this time. So that can be, you can look at it just for ourselves, that in a way, to have to experience all of these things, you know, is painful. On the other hand, if you're a dharmanishta, if you're somebody whose life is committed to dharma and to this knowledge, then in the scale of the balance of dharma adharma in the creation, you are making a wonderful contribution to the good. And there have to be people who are making a contribution to the good, or to doing, to following dharma, or to being a voice for the people and the animals that have no voice. That's a very important role. And here we are in this situation, and that is our role. And it's a beautiful balance of the adharma, and the adharma has to be balanced. You know, it's not that we don't have our own adharmas, but we are not adharmis. That is not our value system. You know, we're not proud of our adharma. You know, we don't relish our adharma as though that's the cool way to be. What's the matter with all these weaklings, you know, that care about other people unnecessarily? You know? So that's more Rakshasa attitude. You know? So I when I think, well, I'm born in a difficult time, I'm happy to be born in this time also. And so I give that same thing to the kids, the little ones. They're born, they've taken birth at this time. You know, they're born in very dharmic, beautiful families. And so they are going to hold the balance. They're here to hold the balance. That's what they're doing. So you can't judge, really. You don't know. You don't know. It's very complicated. It's infinite complexity. So you just have to have shraddha that you've been born at this time for what is best for the world and what is best for you also in terms of your growth. I think that's a good way to look at it. I think it's true also. It's not just a good one. And it rings true. Could you explain the word adhishtana and the difference between mitya and maya again? Sure. The word, you know, in the verse today, it said that when we did today in Brahmashriya, Maya, I see Maya is Brahmashriya, Maya. Ashriya means that which is like the basis, like this is an Ashriya for everything that's on top of it. But when we use this word Ashriya, say Brahman, I mean, Brahman is the Ashriya, the basis for Maya. It's not as though Maya is sitting on top, a real Maya is sitting on top of Brahman. So what we mean by Ashriya in this sense, when the thing that's sitting that has Brahman for its Ashriya, we are talking about with the universe as mitya, right? That is Maya's order of reality. So when we say Brahmashriya, Maya, we are using the word Ashriya as adhishtana. You know, Brahman is the adhishtana of Maya. Now, adhishtana is the word for something like a word like Ashriya, but only in reference to mitya. You know, so the adhishtana, that's how we use it. Brahman is the adhishtana for mitya, for Maya, because Maya is mitya. If I say Maya is mitya, it means that Maya has no being of its own to be sitting on anything. Right? It has no being. Its only being is the adhishtana. Like the snake is not really sitting on the rope as a thing, as though it's a snake. I suppose that could happen. You could have a rope there, and a real snake is lying on top of the rope. Then it would be, yes, that rope is the ashraya for the snake. It just loves to lie in the snake, and it loves to lie in the rope. But that's not how we're using that example. When we're using the rope snake example, the snake is not real. It is mitya. It has no independent being, okay? And so that's what mitya means. In terms of the order of reality, something that is mitya has no independent being whatsoever. It's totally dependent on its being on something else. And in reference to that something else is satyam in reference to the mitya. And that satyam, that thing that is real in reference to the thing that is unreal but experienced, is called the adhishtana. So the rope is the adhishtana of the snake. It's only an adhi, that word only applies if the snake is mitya, if it has no being apart from the rope. Then the rope becomes the adhishtana of the mitya snake. The clay is the adhishtana of the mitya pot. The pot is mitya because there's really nothing there but clay, but we experience the pot, right? And so now in reference to me, the body, mind, sense organs complex, everything that makes up all of the upadis, all of the conditioning adjuncts, which are a product of maya, are mitya, right? Because they depend totally on me for their satchit, for their being. And so the satchit atma is the adhishtana for these mitya upadis. And so now in reference to maya and Brahman, maya is that incidental attribute of Brahman made of sattva, rajas, and tamas, which we experience when it comes into manifestation. We experience the whole creation. But what is the order of reality that this maya enjoys? We say, it is mitya. Why? Why is it mitya? Because it comes into being and goes out of being. It has no being of its own. And yet we experience it. It itself has no being. It's totally dependent on something else for its being. What it is dependent on for its being is its adhishtana. The adhishtana, you know, that is the truth of the mithya maya, is Brahman. The Satchitatma Brahman, because Brahman is itself existence. Does it come into being? Does it go out of being? It is. So Brahman is the Satchit, the existence and conscious being, the conscious being, which the whole maya upadi rests on as Brahman being its adhishtana. Because when you analyze maya, it does not fit the definition of satyam. The definition for these are ontological terms. They're terms about the nature of the reality of something. So the definition of satyam is that which can never be negated in past, present, or future, or that which exists positively, that which exists in all three periods of time. That's what we mean by satyam. There's nothing in the universe that fulfills that definition. Everything in the universe is bound by time and change. Okay, so it's also, though, that's Brahman. Mitya doesn't fulfill that definition because it's continually changing, coming into being and going out of being. You know, if you analyze it, you can't really find anything there. So that order, that maya, doesn't fulfill the definition of satyam, because then it would have to be always the same. They're timeless. It has to be timeless. This maya is not timeless. It's coming into manifestation, going out of manifestation. Everything's coming into being and going out of being. So it is what we call mitya. Mitya means two meanings. First one, in this sense, that which totally depends upon, 100% depends upon something else for its being. So this maya depends 100% on Brahman for its being. So it is mitya. We could say that it is another option. It could be absolutely non-existent, but if we're absolutely tucham, we wouldn't be able to experience it. If it's absolute non-existence, there's no experience of it, because it's simply not there. Whereas mithya is not tucham. It's not absolutely non-existent because we experience it. But it's also not satyam because it's bound by change. And so we have this huge middle category that the entire universe, subtle, physical, subtle, even causal, both fits in to mithya. Because it's subject to birth and death, it's subject to change, it comes into being and goes out of being, so it has no being really of its own, and yet when it's there, it is. It is, it is, it is, it is. The isness is Brahman. Yes. That isness is my amness. You are arness. The floor is isness. It's just language. There's no objectification of isness. It's the adhishtana of the whole creation. There's nothing away from it. You simply cannot have an experience separate from being. Nor can you have an experience separate from consciousness. Neither one is objectifiable, so they're both exactly the same. There's not two things. Existence is consciousness. Consciousness is existence. So, Maya has this term mithya because it has no independent being of its own. It's an ontological term. Brahman is satyam, means that it is being itself. It's free from time. And so it's never not there. And so that bit, Brahman really is the only thing that is satyam. That's an order of reality, that which is real. Mithya is dependent on what is satyam for its being. If you were to take away the satyam, there would be nothing there. So Maya is mithya. And then there's tucham, absolute non-existence, which is not applicable here. It's not really applicable anywhere. But we use it. We use it to differentiate mithya from satyam. You know. So. You can ask again. It takes a while to really all this to sink in. When you say that self-knowledge is the resolution to human suffering, do you mean that I need to explain and show the inner child who is afraid of suffering that I am the peace? To show that the child can resolve itself into my being, or am I bypassing something if I just resolve the child into my being? Oh, read this page first. Okay. I notice an inner child who screams in terror that it doesn't want to live. It doesn't want to live because of all the suffering in the world. I can also see how that may have influenced my mumukshutvam. I haven't been able to comfort the child, and it affects my mood to be tired and not be able to feel gratitude for what is. On another level, I can experience how my being is the source of shanti, acceptance, love, etc. When you say that self-knowledge is the resolution to human suffering, do you mean that I need to explain and show the inner child who is afraid of suffering that I am the peace, to show that the child can resolve itself into my being, or am I bypassing something if I just resolve the child into my being? Bypassing, when we talk about bypassing, I think it has to do with mixing orders of reality, you know. And so I can't bypass the pain of a little child by just putting my mind in samadhi. That's because then that little child is still going to come out and still be in pain. You know, it's like a band-aid or a drug or something. You take a drug, the pain goes away, but then the drug wears off and the pain comes back. So, the fact that your buddhi, the one who is in this empirical reality, has knowledge and can and has access. If you have knowledge, you have access. The buddhi has great access to the wholeness, the shanti, the peace of your own being. And that buddhi, like a good mother or father, or like an ishta devata, or a good sit therapist, or a best friend, can go in and be with that little child and give that child the safety and the protection and the love and the patience that it wasn't able to get in that terrifying situation. Or to be able to hold the child as it goes relives its trauma over and over again, but relives it in your presence, the presence of somebody who loves the child and who loves that little one and can stay present and not run away, you know, or not say, you're just too miserable for me, go to your room, please, and shut the door. You know, that kind of fear, where there's that fear of that rejection, where you can go in as the one who will never reject, will always hold, will always welcome, will be patient, and let all of this process work out. And then that trauma, you know, has a chance to express itself and to be held, because it trusts you that you're not going to abandon it. And it takes a lot of trust. And then those hurt parts can heal in that trust. But you're in the same level of reality. You know, you're not bypassing anything. On another note, though, is the one, say, if we're talking about people who have self-knowledge, the buddhi is the one who has self-knowledge, and so that self is ever-present. And so the one that comes to be with the little one is the one who is a voice for the self. But the buddhi is a voice for yourself, because it's the content of the buddhi is me. Sometimes instead of the self, the atma being the buddhi being the voice for the atma, it's the voice of sadness, an emotion that's overwhelming you, or anger. And then the buddhi, instead of being an objective, natural voice of your own being, it is overwhelmed by emotion and becomes a voice for that emotion. And that its knowledge and conclusions that it has are what we call mithyajnanam, because it's still concluding, but the conclusions are very erroneous. They're the conclusions of an angry person, or the conclusions of a depressed person, you know, where that state of mind is not resonant with who you are, with yourself. But say your buddhi is an expression of who you actually are as the Atma. Then when you are able to do this imaginal work and go down and be with the little ones that are kind of sequestered there, you know, kept down inside, holding so much pain and so much affect, your presence there is so healing, because the nature of the self is abhaya. It can't hurt you. It's not in the cards. It's non-dual. Your nature is not going to change on you. Atma won't change. There's nothing more safe or more caring or not. Zero rejection possibilities. Zero unwelcoming possibilities. It's the opposite of that, just naturally, as your very swarupa. And so your own nature then is by nature very healing. You know, but that nature is being expressed by the buddhi that is holding that little child. So that's the more the inner child work. Sometimes you say your little ones are in there and your buddhi is kind of contemplating and just feeling itself. It's kind of a samadhi there, in the sense that your body and mind are totally relaxed, and your own me, your own presence is just totally filling that buddhi, and you can just kind of sink down into your heart, you know, and let the beauty of the self pervade the little ones. It's just a type of imaginal work that you can do that is very healing. Or you can let the buddhi, which is more or less resolved, or where yourself is very, very present in that buddhi, let it take the form of a goddess or the devata, and then go down as Saraswati. Go and meet the little ones as Saraswati or Jnaneshwari or as Dakshinamurti or Ganesha, you know. Take that form and go sit with them, like an Ishtadevata, you know, who is only wanting to help. Those are beautiful meditations. And there's only one self, so the self, if your buddhi is with yourself, then let it take on the form of Bhagavan or Bhagavati in some form, and then be with those little ones. That's also very, very healing and very beautiful. So the inner child who's screaming in terror, well, that really needs you to be with it and to be patient. You know, in between its sobs, you can say things like, "You want to tell me? Tell me what's going on, what's happening." Or else just be patient, be present. Don't feel like you have to get this over with. Just have to be present. And then that'll start. It'll have a life of its own. And it'll change. You'll only cry for so long. Only be terrorized for so long, if you're there with it. Yeah. As somebody who is present to those tears and that tear, it'll come to an end. But maybe not as quickly as you would like. Mm. One thing about gaining knowledge is you learn how to be very patient. You have to slow down to Ishwara's time. Ishwara moves so slowly compared to your mind and your desires, and Ishwara is just going like this. And you're going like this. You have to get slow down. Yesterday you talked about a deity, a woman of knowledge. Can you talk more about her, and what's the difference, similarity between her and Dakshinamurti? Well, you know, there's so many in India, in the Vedic culture, there are so many different devatas and deities, masculine and feminine. And also like Ganesha, who's masculine but has a head of an elephant. It's all of you know. He's a very beloved figure for removing obstacles and just being a very good friend for you to help you. And when times are rough, he will move in and take care of things. He's a good friend. So there are many masculine and feminine deities. And so I was talking about like at Coimbatore, at the Coimbatore Temple in India, there's the Dakshinamurti, there's Nandi, there's Dakshinamurti over here. There's Ganesha over here, and then there's Nandi facing. That Nandi is the kind of the vehicle, the cow that's the vehicle of Dakshinamurti, Shiva, is facing Dakshinamurti. And then there's a little temple over on the side that has the Shivalinga, and then it has Jnaneshwari. So then I was just thinking of those particular deity. So if we say Jnaneshwari, the goddess of Jnanam, the goddess of self-knowledge, so there's a beautiful murti for her. And so there's also Saraswati, who is the goddess of knowledge, more knowledge in terms of singing and music and art and those kind of things, but also the goddess of knowledge, books and all of that. But Jnaneshwari is, I think, specific because Swamiji chose her for that, specific to giving self-knowledge. And so, say, when you go to the temple, like when I go to the temple when I'm in India, then I always will spend some time with Jnaneshwari because she's feminine and she's a teacher, she's a Jnani. And so I'm a feminine woman. It's nice to have a woman. Devata. Yeah. We're not used to that. In our culture, we don't really have that. But in that culture, we do. So you can have, you know, there's that resonance between being a woman and having a woman. You know, goddess, deity. And Dakshinamurti is the first, it's an incarnation of Shiva as the first teacher of this knowledge. And so he's also something, he's our Ishtadevata, really, within our Sampradaya of Swamiji. Dakshinamurti is our Ishtadevata because he's the first teacher of the Sampradaya of this teaching, of the Vedanta, you know. And so... So say Ganesha or Dakshinamurti or Jnaneshwari or Lakshmi, or there's so many to choose from. Say one Devata, maybe we've heard their story or seen the picture of them or a picture of Shiva, or and something resonates with you, then that you have a special relationship with that deity. And so then when you are doing some, in say, inner child work for instance, or if you're just doing some imaginal work in the psyche, you can bring that Ishtadevata with you. Yeah, like Jnaneshwari can be with you, or you can take that form, because you, as you resolve your mind just into yourself, and as that form, you go down and be with those little ones and let them sit with you in that form. Because it's still just the self, but the self in the form of Jnaneshwari or Dakshinamurti or Ganesha, and let them be. You know. Or you can also accompany that Ishtadevata down, and all of you be together, you and the Ishtadevata and the little ones, and let them enjoy that type of love, you know, and that strength. The Devatas, they are so strong. Strong, confident, and very, very secure in themselves. And so you bring that to the little ones. Oh, well, Dakshinamurti is the masculine, and it means the one literally who's facing south. And that means one who's facing death. And so all of the students are facing life, you know. And Dakshinamurti is facing death because for him there's no death. So he can release all of the students as the first teacher. And he's young and handsome and ever fresh. In some of the chants that we do to Dakshinamurti before we start, you know, it's ever youthful, never fresh, never aging. And then Jnaneshwari is just a feminine, you know, goddess of knowledge. Let's see if this isn't hard, I'll answer it. Wait. I've written down Abhaya. Abhaya Karana. I think what you meant is Anta Karana. A-N-T-A-H with a dot under it. K-A-R-A-N with a dot under it. Karana, Anta Karana. Abhaya means free from fear. Karana means either an instrument or a cause, you know. So there's no, to my knowledge, I wouldn't have ever said Abhaya Karana, but they're two separate words, you know. I think you meant Antakarana. Yeah, that's my guess. And Abhaya is that Bha is aspirate, A-B-H-A-Y-A, Abhaya. And Karana, K-A-R-A-N with a dot in there. Ah. What you want is Anta Karana, which is the name for the inner Anta Karana instrument. Anta Karana is the word for the mind, that it has these four different types of categories of thinking. You know, the buddhi, the manas, chitta, the ahankara. Yeah. I think we should stop. One bhajan. Can you do it? Yeah. And then the swasti. Okay.
Shalini, Desho Yamcho Parahitaha, Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukha Bhavet Asato Ma Satgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor Ma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om